The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And as you enjoy the Christmas holiday and perhaps take a moment or two to unwrap a gift or two, we'd like to present a story about unwrapping the ancient past. Now, Unearthing Everyday Life at an Ancient Site in Greece is written by Matt Stern. It appeared in the October 3rd, 2022 issue of the New York Times. It was part of an ongoing special series called Through the Lens. And we're going to learn more as we read the introduction. So are you ready? Let's begin. Here's the introductions. Excavations in the Peloponnesian village of Ecglena are yielding rich insights into the lives of the Mycenaean civilization's general population. And then a little bit more about this series, just so you know. At the onset of the coronavirus pandemic, with travel restrictions in place worldwide, we, that being the New York Times editors, launched a new series, The World Through a Lens, in which photojournalists help transport you virtually to some of our planet's most compelling places. This week, Matt Stern shares a collection of images from the Peloponnese region in southern Greece. As the sun peaked, heat waves rose from the cypress-covered hills around me. The turquoise waters of the Ionian Sea shimmered on the western horizon, and olive groves stretched toward infinity to the east. Over the deafening chorus of cicadas, which indicated we were in the hottest part of the Mediterranean summer, the rhythmic thud of pickaxes echoed across the hilltop, each swing tearing into the rusty red soil of Greece's Peloponnese. Amid the stifling heat, a team of archaeologists, university students, and local workmen were digging deeper into the remains of Ecglena, a Bronze Age city that once ruled the surrounding landscape, according to Homer, and may have played a role in the legendary Trojan War more than 3,000 years ago. Today, the settlement lies burned and buried, offering the researchers an invaluable means of studying the volatile politics of ancient Greece and the complex lives of the Mycenaean people who lived at the crossroads of history and mythology. During the end of Greece's Bronze Age, between approximately 1700 and 1100 BC, Mycenaean civilization flourished throughout the Peloponnesian Peninsula. Ruled by a conglomerate of palaces that oversaw regional kingdoms, Mycenaean society was dominated by war and hostility. Various clans, including Agamemnon from Mycenae and Nestor of Pylos, sought to expand their rule over the land. The period was also rich in cultural and technological advances, including the mainland development of monumental architecture in the form of palaces and vaulted tholos tombs, advancements in ceramics, and the development of Linear B, a script that provides the first written occurrences of the ancient Greek language. In 1876, the German archaeologist Heinrich Schliemann began excavating the fabled city of Mycenae, and in uncovering treasure-laden grave circles of ancient kings, turned the world's attention to the Mycenaean civilization. In the century and a half since Schliemann's great discoveries, the excavation of other Mycenaean palatial sites, including Tiryns, Glei, and Pylos, continued to expand the contemporary understanding of the Bronze Age world. And yet, while research at these sites offered glimpses into Mycenaean politics and the lives of the elite, they did not provide evidence of the lives of the general population, a demographic considered by many to be essential to the understanding of how Mycenaean civilization rose and collapsed. With the hope of filling gaps about the early Greek civilization, archaeologists over the past three decades have sought out towns in lieu of places and palaces and tombs. To date, only a few have ever been excavated in detail. And just to give you an example of some of the things they find, there have been some artifacts that were published with this article, and they were part of academic papers from the Archaeological Society of Athens, and the caption reads, for one photo, from left to right, top to bottom, we have have a squat stirrup jar that likely held perfumed olive oil and was made between 1390 and 1320 BC. Next, we have a ceramic head that might represent a local goddess, a painted female five figurine, and a ceramic deep bowl likely crafted between 1250 and 1190 BC. So that gives you some idea of some of the things they're finding. Back to our article. During the summer of 1999, Michael Cosmopoulos, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a professor of Greek archaeology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, was conducting an archaeological survey with colleagues and students through the rugged and hilly terrain of Messenia, a region along Greece's southwest coast. In particular, the survey team was interested in an olive grove near the quaint mountain village of Ecléna, where in the 1950s, the Greek archaeologist Spyrodon Marinatos found a site that contained an exceptional amount of Bronze Age pottery. On his first visit to the site, Dr. Cosmopoulos noticed that an exceptionally large mound among the olives, and it was based on the sheer quantity of the Mycenaean pottery found on the ground that he suspected a considerable settlement was likely buried beneath his feet. Systematic excavations in 2009 revealed that the mysterious mound was in fact the buried remains of the Cyclopean Terrace, a multi-story building foundation constructed of massive boulders, typically found only at palaces and important Mycenaean capitals. Using magnetometry and electric resistivity techniques used to look for buried architecture, the researchers scanned the surrounding area in order to seek out the boundaries of the site and to help them plan where to focus digging. Now, the results were shocking. Not only were there dozens of buildings surrounding the terrace, but the labyrinth of structures extended to an area nearly 32 acres. Now, Ecléna was not simply confined to a confined palace, or elite residence. Rather, it was an entire city with houses, streets, and workshops. Over the past 16 years, the work at Ecléna represents the most comprehensive excavation of a Mycenaean regional capital. Excavations conducted on and around the Cyclopean Terrace revealed an elite district composed of plazas, paved roads, and administrative buildings with large megara, or great halls, used for formal events at the center. Ceramic pipes used for distributing fresh water were found running beneath the site, and a network of stone drains provided an elaborate system of sewage. In the interior of several rooms, the team found the remains of vibrant frescoed walls depicting scenes with ships, fish, and people. Based on the way the buildings and walls were built on top of one another, researchers contend that the site was likely occupied between 1800 and 1200 BC. And parenthetically, they note the existence of several collapsed walls and burned buildings suggest multiple phases of construction and destruction. It was a burned pit next to a building that the team made an exceptional discovery. It was a fragment of clay Linear B tablet describing what appears to be an economic transaction dating to around 1350 BC. The tablet represents one of the earliest records of bureaucracy found anywhere in Europe. Beneath an olive grove next to the original palatial discovery, the team uncovered a large residential and commercial complex that has provided a rare and much sought-after glimpse into conventional Mycenaean culture. If we want to reconstruct ancient society and learn how it developed, we cannot just look at the palatial sites and monuments, Dr. Cosmopoulos explained. We need to seek a balanced view of everyday life. Analysis of the ceramics at Ecléna shows that while some pottery was traded throughout the Mediterranean, local craftsmen, by and large, made their own wares from local clay. Recovered animal bones and charred plant remains have revealed the importance of cows, sheep, and pigs and the prevalence of olives and grapes in local Mycenaean agriculture. The discovery of specialty artifacts like clay spindle whorls helps identify where fabric was once made, and figurines found alongside charred bones indicate areas of possible ritualistic or religious importance. Examinations of destroyed architectural layers showed that Ecléna was likely ruled as its own entity before being sacked and annexed by the kings of Pylos. That discovery has provided a fresh perspective of how Mycenaean states developed and suggests rather than growing as a single unified kingdom, a conglomerate of competing rulers unified smaller regional capitals such as Eklaena to amass power. The Eklaena Project, conducted under the auspices of the Archaeological Society of Athens with the permission of Mycenaean Ephorate and Greek Ministry of Culture and Sports, has required a team of researchers with expertise in the Mediterranean Bronze Age, ceramics, architecture, biomolecular analysis, geochemistry, remote sensing, and artifact conservation, among other disciplines. During a typical four-week excavation season, between 15 and 20 professional archaeologists from the United States, Greece, and Canada work alongside laborers hired from the Eklaena village, with their work orchestrated by Dr. Deborah Russillo, the project's assistant director and a specialist in animal bones and ancient diets. A dozen additional specialists can be found each day at the project's lab and repository, processing and studying artifacts that are brought in from the field. Students have also played a major role in the excavations, which have acted as field school for people interested in becoming professional archaeologists, Dr. Cosmopoulos said. He and his fellow professionals want to help the students understand the relevance of ancient cultures to modern society and their own lives, he added. From the beginning, the team has involved the modern village of Eklaena by hiring locals to work at the site and inviting locals to see the excavations. For some people, having income opportunities close to home is the main draw, but many others are fascinated with the ancient city and the opportunity to connect with their ancestors. It's neat to see the villagers embrace the ancient site as part of their community, Dr. Russillo added, and she said, over the years, Eklaena has experienced a kind of reawakening. The modern town has come to life again with excitement, she said. The locals have also embraced their role as caretakers. Each winter, as the researchers return home and the site goes dormant, Eklaena's villagers stand watch over the site, guarding it as an extension of their own community. One of his dreams, Dr. Cosmopoulos said, is to turn the ancient town into an open-air museum where people can visit and learn about Mycenaean culture. Archaeology needs to contribute to wider communities, he explained. The prefecture of Peloponnese recently approved funding to build a road to the site, and as the plans are made to expand access, modern Eklaena hopes that heritage tourism will share their village's deep history with the world and continue to bring more jobs to the community. History belongs to everybody, Dr. Russillo said. Archaeology loses its value when you can't share it with people, and one of the most important things we can do is encourage everyone to take care of the history together and truly respect it. And by the way, a writer-photographer for the article, Matt Stern, is also an archaeologist and photojournalist. He's based in Boston, also has a place in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and you can Google his name, Matt Stern, S-T-I-R-N. He has worked that you can follow on Instagram. So if you'd like to learn more about archaeological excavations and expeditions, as it were. Our next article is written by David Brown and appeared in the September 30th, 2022 issue of the Washington Post. Now, as we'll hear, Brown seeks to unwrap the history of a famous Scottish city and discovers how similar it is to his hometown of Baltimore. Now, it's headlined, "In Scotland, a city's world-class industrial past informs its present." And we're going to begin by reading the caption of a photo that accompanies the article. And so here we go. And the caption reads, "As part of Dundee's waterfront preservation, the city has saved workshops and offices that whisper the city's importance as a whaling, import, and shipbuilding powerhouse." And David Brown of the Washington Post took this photo, just to give him some credit there. "Now, some cities have a past that is beautiful in the present," writes our author, David Brown. "Old buildings and public spaces effortlessly become tourist attractions long after their reason for being has disappeared. Venice is like that. So is Paris. Other cities carry their past into the present as an unavoidable burden, sprucing up their edges with beautiful things, new and old, and distract attention. Dundee on the east coast of Scotland is one of those. So is Baltimore, my home," he writes. "I spent most of a week in Dundee last spring," that would have been in 2022, "while doing archival research in St. Andrews, 13 miles to the south across the River Tay, Scotland's longest river. Every day I commuted to my hotel, 40 minutes by bus, in a real city, as I had between Washington and Baltimore for 22 years. And I came away a fan, more than a fan, actually, when I left, and my breast was the defensive love felt by people who stumble into what has into has-been cities, and they stay, and as I've done in Baltimore for more than half my life. Dundee, like Baltimore, is a city whose great days are a century gone. It has world-class industrial past and a vast inventory of vacant industrial buildings in the present, like Baltimore. Both cities have a dominant and oppressive building material, red brick in Baltimore, and in Dundee, a local sandstone that can't make up its mind whether it's tan or gray. As in Baltimore, some of these buildings, wonderful ones, have been repurposed, like the hotel I stayed in an old linen mill. Both cities have signature culinary products, crabs in Baltimore and marmalade in Dundee. Both have a lot of litter. Both are defaced or decorated with graffiti, depending on your taste. Dundee has the highest crime rate of cities in Scotland, while Baltimore ranks third in the United States. Where does one begin to learn about Dundee's history and heart? Well, luckily for a tourist, there is a place. It's called Verdant Works, a former jute mill in a part of the city known as Blackness. Now, Dickens couldn't have come up with a better name. Once the employer of 500 people, the mill is a keyhole through which most of Dundee's history can be described. Unlike many factory museums, its story is made vivid by docents, only one or two generations removed from its inescapable clutches. But before we spend an afternoon there, we're going to look around. And we begin with this section, a vibrant maritime history. Dundee is part of the Firth of Tay, the place where the river widens into a tidal estuary before entering the North Sea. It was built on trade, and for many centuries it was Scotland's second most important city behind Edinburgh. It is maritime past telegraphed in street names, Chandler's Lane, East Whale Lane, stone workshops along the waterfront, a compact maritime trail where its piers and shipyards once stood, and a small collection of historic ships. Of the last, the most notable is the Discovery. Now, that's a three-masted sailing vessel that also had a steam engine. Built as the first ship designed specifically for scientific research, there was no iron or steel within a 30-foot radius of its magnetic observatory. It was built in Dundee in 1901 and owned by the Royal Geographical Society. The Discovery's most famous voyage was a four-year trip to Antarctica featuring two of Britain's legendary explorers, Robert Falcon Scott, the captain, and Ernest Shackleton, the third officer. Visitors are allowed to go almost anywhere on it. In that regard, it's better than Baltimore's estimable Constellation, built in 1854 and used to catch slave traders, among other tasks. On the pier next to it is Dundee, an offspring of London's Victoria and Albert Museum. Like its parent, it's dedicated to design, decorative arts, and performance. Opened in 2018, the V&A is the antithesis of Discovery, no vertical lines in view and clad in what looks like a grate from a pier. But it's just as interesting, with a wonderful collection that includes a salvaged tea room from Glasgow that was designed by Scotland's Art Nouveau genius Charles Rennie Mackintosh. The ship and the museum are the most visible pieces of a 30-year, nearly $2 billion development project along 5 miles of waterfront. A 15-minute walk inland is the McManus, a gallery and museum. That's a good place to see art and artifact telling Dundee's story. That includes areas as Britain's most important whaling port, a textile and shipbuilding center, and in the second half of the 20th century, the British home to American companies, including Timex and National Cash Register. As in Baltimore, Dundee's shipyards and factories eventually closed. The city lost 10,000 manufacturing jobs in the 1980s. Like Baltimore, it's now trying to cobble a future out of tourism, biotech, and lots of little companies. There's a lot to see in Dundee's environs, including castles and archaeological sites, but if you have time for only one stop, make it Verdant Works. The museum stands in for more than 100 jute mills that once operated in Dundee and employed by the late 1800s 40,000 of the city's 170,000 residents. The jute era? Jute? Well, it's a fiber made from a middle layer of a 12-foot-high grass that grows mostly in India and Bangladesh, and it's a competitor to hemp. you make burlap from jute. From burlap in the old days, you made the binding of cotton bales and sacks for coffee, cocoa, sugar, potatoes, and lots of other things. Woven tire, it became cloth for tents and the covers for artillery pieces. War was good business for jute. In 1 2-week period during World War I, 150 million jute sandbags were shipped out of Dundee. So how did a city on the North Sea come to process fiber grown in South Asia? Well, in the 1700s, Dundee developed a linen industry, importing flax from the Baltic states and other high-latitude countries where it grew. By 1840, the city had overtaken Leeds in England in the production of coarse linen. The Crimean War, which ran from 1853 to 1856, however, interrupted the flax trade. Dundee's industrialists realized they had the knowledge and labor to process, spin, and weave other fibers. Imperial Britain had access to flax alternative growing in its colony, India. At a little time, and Dundee became the jute capital of the world. A small thing that made a big difference was Dundee's whaling fleet. At some point, the mill managers discovered that washing the raw fiber in a mixture of 90% water and 10% whale oil made jute less likely to snag in fast-moving machinery. This 10% solution was enough to keep Dundee's whaling industry alive 50 years longer than almost anywhere else in the world. Next section is titled Only Show in Town. The first docent I encountered at Verdant Works was Ian Finley, a 73-year-old retired civil servant. His mother's mother was a jute weaver. His father's mother was a jute spinner. His father's father was a maintenance engineer in a jute mill. It was the only show in town, to be honest, he said. On the factory floor, I met another man, Lane Sward, also 73, whose jute pedigree wasn't as long. His father left school at 14 and was a jute salesman, mostly to the carpet industry, his whole life. Sword had been a banker around the United Kingdom before retiring to Dundee, his hometown. He was a jute Wikipedia and no apologist for the mill owners. He told me that when Britain finally required public education, Dundee mill owners successfully petitioned to be an exception. They got permission to employ half-timers, children who'd work 30 hours a week in the mill for minuscule pay and go to school for half days only. They were so good at crawling under machinery and pulling out dust and fibers. Well, in fact, 70% of mill workers in Dundee were women and children who were paid less than men. The city was known as the She-Town and was the first place in Scotland where jailed suffragettes went on hunger strikes. It was also full of men raising children and drinking too much. In part as a consequence of these conditions, 63% of Dundee's eligible men fought in World War I, where they were slaughtered in droves. A battalion known as Dundee's Own sent 423 men and 20 officers into battle in Loos, France, in September 1915. All but one of the officers were killed, as were 230 enlisted men. The McManus has a spectacular painting of 24 Dundonians, that's what the city residents are called, standing in the ruined landscape after another battle, Neuve Chapelle. The painter, Joseph Gray, who lived from 1890 to 1962, had been a newspaper artist in Dundee. Everyone in the painting is identified. Working conditions were just very hard. It's very difficult to think of what life was like, Sword said, between explanations of how various pieces of machinery operated. A glimpse of that life, however, comes through in a remarkable piece of public health research published by the Royal Society of London in 1886. The authors were three men, Dundee's health officer, a chemist at University College in London, and a second scientist at that institution, J.S. Haldane, who would become the most important respiratory physiologist of his generation. The team took air samples from tenements occupied by mill families, 29 one-bedroom and 13 two-bedroom dwellings, and from 18 dwellings of four or more bedrooms occupied by middle and upper-class families. They measured temperature, carbon dioxide, a product of respiration and a measure of crowding, as well as organic matter, basically dust, and bacteria and mold. The samples were taken during the night between 12:30 a.m. and 4:30 a.m., the scientist wrote. The houses were visited without warning of any kind to the inhabitants so as to avoid the risk of having rooms specially ventilated in preparation for our visit. In every case but one, we were most civilly received. The average number of sleepers per room in the one-room flats was 6.6, in the two-room ones, 6.8, and in the houses of four or more rooms, 1.3. At 52 pages, it's a long and complicated study that highlights the dramatic effects of crowding. Compared with four-room houses, one-room ones had air with twice as much carbon dioxide, four times as much dust, and seven times as many microorganisms. The most important data, however, was provided by Dundee's health officer. The death rate of children was four times higher in one-room tenements than in four-room houses. Residents living in one room have the chance of birth of living only one-half as long as those in better-class houses, or they die nearly 20 years sooner on the average than those of the better class, they wrote. At this, the scientists couldn't restrain themselves. This is an enormous difference. Other research found the teenage boy mill workers were 4.5 inches shorter and a stone lighter, that's about 14 pounds, than rural teenagers in Scotland. Haldane's most famous son, mathematician and geneticist J.B.S. Haldane, later said of his father, his experience of the Dundee slums may not have made him a radical, but it kept him one. What Dundee needs in his version of the New York's Tenement Museum, or even Baltimore's modest Irish Railroad Workers Museum, to bring these conditions to life. Next section, the jobs leave. Jute mill owners eventually found a way to make even more money. They moved the business to India, closer to the fiber source. Dundee lost a whole industry, much of its culture, and untold thousands of people. Before, it had been a place where a boy with mechanical aptitude could advance, even if he left school at 14. The loss of the textile industry pretty much led to the loss of all that, Lane Sward told me. But remnants of the jute trade are still visible in Dundee if you keep an eye out. Passing trash-strewn factory yard early in my visit, I saw at the far end a sign over a door. Drivers should not stand under slings while bales are being hoisted. Jute bales, compressed rock hard to save space on shipment from India, weigh 400 pounds. The city's also full of concert halls, parks, pools, and other public amenities that might not exist but for the barons. They have generously, rather, they gave generously while mercilessly exploiting their workers, like Andrew Carnegie, a Scot whose wealth paid for more than 1,500 libraries in the United States. Verdant Works shows this story and doesn't just tell it. The exhibits are clever and moving. Physical objects butt up against photographs of people doing work with these same objects. You feel as if you're in a diorama or on stage in a play. Mural-sized photographs make faces larger than life. You can't help pondering the individuality of the people staring at you. It's a place to feel the beating heart in the stony heart of a city. And if you do decide to go, here are some traveling tips. You can stay at the Hotel Indigo Dundee. This is at Lower Dens Mill, Constable Street in Dundee. It's an upscale hotel, five-story repurposed textile mill with a bell tower and within walking distance of Dundee's downtown sites. So there you go. Some travel to Dundee, Scotland is going to bring an end to today's journey of Armchair Traveler. I certainly hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now, Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.